regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad you're with me on the program today. We're going to be talking with Eric Dilbert from LEPD Farms and Range in Columbus, Ohio. A couple of things to talk about, but you know, now that we are officially less than 2 weeks away from Election Day, I thought it'd be a good idea to kind of check in with some of our friends in some of the battleground swing states around the country, just to get sort of an on-the-ground report from a Second Amendment perspective. I mean, we're obviously seeing some coverage of the elections in places like Michigan and Wisconsin, Nevada, but most of the political reporters out there are not going to gun stores. They're not talking specifically to gun owners, and they're not talking specifically about the gun vote. But Eric Dilbert from LEPD Farms and Range there in Columbus can give us that perspective there in the Buckeye State, at least the central part of the Buckeye State. So I wanted to have Eric on to talk about that, because not only are we talking about the presidential race in Ohio, but you've got a hugely competitive Senate race. And kind of flying even more under the radar, you've got state Supreme Court elections that could have a major impact in terms of our Second Amendment rights going forward, at least in the state of Ohio. So without any further ado, let's kick off the conversation with Eric Dilbert from LEPD Farms and Range. Take a look and a listen. Eric, thanks so much for coming on the show. It's good to see you again, sir.
Always good to see you. Always good to be here.
Well, listen, I thought about this. We're now less than 2 weeks away from Election Day. And I thought, you know, I've got a lot of folks who I talk to all the time in these battleground swing states, and you're one of them. I mean, you're right there in Ohio, and polls look pretty good for Donald Trump in Ohio. I think he's polling outside of the margin of error. But, you know, you've got this really contentious Senate race that could ultimately determine, you know, which party's in control of the Senate. And then you've also got some state Supreme Court races that could flip control of the state Supreme Court. If Democrats were to sweep all three of these races, you'd go from a 4-3 majority of Republican, right? Because these are partisan elections in Ohio. You'd go from a 4-3 Republican majority to basically a 4-3 Democrat majority. And that could mean all kinds of bad news for gun owners and Second Amendment supporters in the state.
And it's even beyond that, Cam. I mean, we have this issue one that's getting a lot of attention now. And if that goes through, that goes to how these districts are even formed. And so, I mean, that's a huge thing. We're trying to get out the vote no on issue one. But that in conjunction with what you said, there's a lot at stake here in Ohio.
Absolutely. So, obviously you're there in the Columbus area. That is one of the Democratic strongholds of the state. But do you have a sense of how the elections are going? Maybe just again, with your customer base there at LEPD Farms and Range, are people engaged? Are they aware? Are they motivated? Are they fired up and ready to vote? Are they sick of the robocalls? Are they tuned out of the election completely?
Kind of all of the above. But, you know, we're still a little disappointed, because we're trying to get the message out that if you're a firearm owner, if you're a gun owner, a Second Amendment enthusiast, you got to vote. And you hear these stories about how so many of the gun owners are sitting on the sidelines and there's too much at stake. In Ohio, we're pretty much a stronghold, I would say, for President Trump. I don't like to get too over excited about that, but it's looking very good. The problem, though, that I don't want to happen is that people say, you know what, Ohio is going to go to Trump, I don't have to vote. And what's equally as important in Ohio is that issue one, but also the Senate seat with Bernie Moreno versus the old Sherrod Brown. And I'm worried that if people stay home, that it's not going to pull Bernie through. If people get out to vote like they say they're going to, and Trump wins Ohio by the margins that we think he can, we're hoping that inadvertently pulls Bernie through. But it's tough. I mean, we have to get out there. We've been talking to Bernie all, you know, regularly and stuff, and we just got to get people to go out to vote.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm just looking at the Real Clear Politics averages here for Trump versus Harris in Ohio. The average is a Trump 7-point lead, right? And the polls have been pretty consistent over the past couple of months. Trump by 7, Trump by 6, Trump by 6, Trump by 6, Trump by 7. But then, as you say, you look at that Senate race, and it's much tighter. Real Clear Politics has right now Sherrod Brown up by 0.6%. in their aggregate of polls. Now, the latest poll that came out was a Rasmussen poll 1,051 likely voters. That had Bernie Moreno up by a single point. Two previous polls had Moreno by one, or had a Brown by one, Brown by two. So as you say, I mean, that is a critically important race. I mean, we've seen so many Democrats around the country this year, Eric, talk about how if they get elected, they're going to vote to repeal the filibuster. Right. So Democrats could pass a ban on, you know, semi-automatic firearms with 51 votes, get that to a potential President Kamala Harris, who I'm sure would be happy to sign that ban. Right. I mean, this is real here. This isn't, you know, fear mongering. This isn't scare tactics. Ohio voters and Ohio gun owners have a crucial role to play in this election in terms of safeguarding their Second Amendment rights.
We do. And we have to listen to what they're saying. I mean, no longer do they hide it. They say it out loud. And when you look at Kamala saying that, you know, even if you legally possess a firearm, we're going to have the ability to come into your home. I mean, these are the things you have to take seriously. I spoke to Bernie last week. He sent me a text after our radio show and said, hey, look, I need some range time. He's been going crazy all over the state. He says, if I come in tomorrow, can we shoot a couple rounds? So I had an opportunity to spend 2 hours with him one-on-one and talk about a lot of these issues. And they're concerned. They're concerned what a Harris administration will do to the Second Amendment. And because they say it. I mean, one of her things that we played on our show last week, when somebody asked her about mandatory buybacks, the moderator said, well, how mandatory are these? And she responded by saying, oh, they're mandatory. I mean, that's gun confiscation. And if that gets to the point where she gets in and a Sherrod Brown gets reelected, we're potentially in real trouble when it comes to the Second Amendment.
Absolutely. Now, one of the things that I've noticed around the country as well, Eric, is that a lot of these Senate candidates, and even to some degree, Kamala Harris and Tim Walz themselves, have stopped talking as much about gun control over the last, let's say, month of the campaign, right? They don't even want to bring it up. You're even seeing, like, you know, Bob Casey in Pennsylvania cutting ads where I stand with Trump on, you know, issue X, right? They're now trying to embrace Trump as opposed to distance themselves from Trump. What is Sherrod Brown's messaging in Ohio? Is he talking about guns or gun control at all, or is he just kind of leaving that aside?
He's leaving it aside. And what's scary, and I saw something that this is occurring in other states as well. If you didn't know anything, if you just stepped into Ohio for the first time and you didn't know the candidates and you watched some of the Sherrod Brown commercials, you could think that, oh, this guy's a conservative. The way he's running the commercials on, you know, I stand with Trump on this and I've done this, it appears at times that he's a conservative candidate, of which he's anything but. But that's what they're having to do to try to get people to believe that they're somewhere in the middle when they're actually not.
Yeah, it is amazing to me that, you know, we are seeing so many folks on the left run from their positions, not run on their positions when it comes to our right to keep and bear arms. You know, we're told all the time, oh, Americans by, you know, large margins support these common sense gun safety measures. Well, if that was really true, then the candidates would be running on these issues right up until Election Day, right? They would be front and center because these would be issues that would appeal to a majority of the electorate. Instead, we're seeing the opposite. We're seeing candidate after candidate shy, no pun intended, they're getting gun shy, right? When it comes to talking about Second Amendment issues, a lot more talk about, I'm a Second Amendment supporter, I'll stand up for your right to keep and bear arms. Maybe they'll say something, you know, about, you know, vague common sense gun safety regulations that don't infringe on your right to keep and bear arms. We're not taking everybody's guns away. That type of language just camouflages their actual positions. And I appreciate you and what you're doing with the radio show. And then just, you know, with your customers at LAPD Farms and Range, you know, letting them know the truth about this, because you're right. If there are low information voters out there, and listen, I get it. If you don't want to pay attention to politics, I completely understand. But if you are a low information voter, if you're not continually, you know, tuned in, you're exactly right. You're going to get a false impression of who a lot of these candidates are and what they stand for.
And I feel, and I never intended to be in this position. I mean, we wanted to open up a gun store. We wanted to help law enforcement, but we found ourselves kind of being thrust with the radio show into a little bit of the political side of things. So I feel like it's our role in these circumstances to be able to talk firsthand about our interactions with Bernie. Most people don't get the luxury of being able to sit down with a candidate for hours in a casual scenario. But I feel like it's important for us to say, look, he is a legitimate supporter of the Second Amendment. I sat there. I shot with him for 2 hours. We went through the Ohio Police Officers Training Academy course. I put him through it just for fun. He passed it right away. He's legitimately on our side. And so I think it's important for voters to hear that, not just, you know, oh, it's a politician who says they're for the Second Amendment, but what's he really going to do if he gets in there? Bernie is legitimate in his desire to keep and bear arms and you know, other rights as well. But it's important for us to know that.
Absolutely. I mean, heck, just the fact that he, you know, called you up and said, hey, can I come just go shoot? Because I need a break from the campaign trail. He didn't bring the cameras along, right? He didn't bring any reporters with him. This was just him showing up to do some shooting.
Just a couple guys at the range shooting. And it was, I mean, it was really good. We tried different things. I was, you know, trying what his carry gun was. Actually, I think I convinced him that he needs a new carry gun. I guess it's my sales side coming through. But yeah, it was a great few hours here at the range where he kind of, you know, let his guard down a little bit and had some fun.
And unlike the event in Missouri yesterday featuring the Democratic candidate for senators running against Josh Hawley, nobody got injured by shrapnel. You guys weren't shooting sealed targets at like 7 to 10 yards with AR-15s. Nothing stupid like that, right?
No, nothing at all. All done in a safe environment. Yep.
All right. Now, I do want to ask you, too, because there is a and you and I have talked before about some of these officer involved shootings in Columbus. There is a officer who's on trial this week right now, right, in the shooting of somebody who did not have a gun. The officer believed that he had a firearm. Can you give us some background on this case, Eric?
Yeah, this is actually a 2020 case. Happened in December of 2020. Just now coming to trial, partly because the officer himself came down with cancer, has had some health issues, and so it's gotten put off until now. It's a tragic event. It is. Anytime there's a loss of life, even if you look at that person, you'd say, hey, he's a bad guy in society. It's always tragic when there's loss of life. In this particular case, convoluted call, they go to a house for disturbance, turns out more to be a kind of a suspicious person, suspicious car call. The individual, Andre Hill, acting very strange in his mannerisms, you know, everything keeps building, and it culminates into Mr. Hill coming out of a garage, dark garage, Officer Coy walking up to him. To this point, Mr. Hill really hadn't said anything to officers over a course of 30 minutes with some interactions with them. He kept holding up a cell phone as if to show them to read a message on the phone. And so he came out of the garage again with that cell phone up, now looking at really the totality of the circumstances. The officers, you know, didn't know if that was a decoy. Hey, look at this hand, but in my other hand, I have something. And at a split second, Officer Hill, either by intent or by, you know, negligence, raised his right hand coming across a car, ended up having a handful of keys, unfortunately. But the perception from Officer Coy was that he had a small revolver, even to the point he yelled gun, gun, gun to other officers on the scene. I mean, showing that his perception was that this guy had a gun. There was a perceived threat. Unfortunately, Officer or the subject, Mr. Hill, was shot and killed. Tragic. But is it a murder conviction? Absolutely not. Not by the standards that we have to work under in law enforcement. So, you know, it'll be interesting to see how it plays out. And hopefully the judge will bring in some of these standards that we go by and go from there.
Yeah. You know, tell me about Ohio law. I mean, Was manslaughter an option for prosecutors? I mean, murder seems like a pretty high bar here.
He's charged with multiple things. And honestly, okay, I don't even know what he's charged with. But it all goes back to, and you know, when we were in the police academy and throughout our training, even to this day, something called the case of Graham versus Connor comes up. I don't know if you've had an opportunity to read that case. It's from the 80s. And it truly is what law enforcement use of deadly force is based upon. And it basically said, they said, look, you can't judge an officer's action on 2020 hindsight. You can't judge them knowing what we know now. You have to look at it, what an objectively reasonable officer would have done in that same circumstance. And so when you look at that and, you know, it recognizes that these deadly force incidences or force incidences in general are tense, ever evolving, they're uncertain. And it says, what would another officer would have done? And in this case, you know, the way the Supreme Court ruling reads, was it a threat, either actual or perceived? It was a perceived threat. Was it the wrong perception? It was, but considering the totality of it, and there's much more, you know, that led up to the actual shooting that day. Looking at the totality of it, was it reasonable for an officer in his position to have that same perception and do what he did? And it is. Is it unfortunate? Absolutely, 100%. Is it a civil case that should be paid out? Well, the city's already done that. But it's just one of those things that you know, if we're going to be to look at these based upon our laws, then we have to look at it under that regards until they change it. I mean, if that standard changes, then it changes. But that's what we're based on these days.
Yeah. And I mean, and listen, I mean, I know that there is, you know, there's some Americans out there who just say anytime there's an officer involved shooting, basically it's guilty until they prove themselves innocent. Right. And I don't know all of the specific facts of this case, but, you know, I would be very cautious of any sort of legislative change that would remove that language about a perceived threat, because I mean, we see this with non-law enforcement shootings, right? We see this with defensive gun uses. I had a story yesterday at Bearing Arms out of Seattle where a clerk at a gas station saw a couple of people doing drugs in their car. He went up to them and said, "You need to leave." One of the guys threatened him, said, "I have a gun. I'm going to shoot you." So the clerk retreated back to his own vehicle, grabbed his gun. The guy then approaches the car and the clerk shoots the suspect because he perceived a legitimate threat against his life at that point. He wasn't arrested. No gun was found at the scene. It could be that the guy's accomplice, you know, grabbed the gun and took off into the night. We don't know, but police didn't find a gun. So again, do we think that clerk should be charged with, you know, murder or manslaughter, or was there a legitimate perceived threat to his life? And I would argue in that case there was. So, you know, I hate that we have this tendency, and again, I think it's just human nature to sort of leap to conclusions, right? We'll see a headline, we'll read maybe one story and say, okay, we know what happened. But you know, I would always caution folks. I mean, if this case goes to trial, and it sounds like it is, you know, learn as much as you can about the testimony that's given, because when you sit and you watch the trial, I mean, I'll give you another perfect example of this. Kyle Rittenhouse, even after Kyle Rittenhouse was acquitted, you know, you've got people who are just making up stuff that never happened, right? Either the night of the shooting or during his trial. But I watched every minute of that trial, and the prosecution simply did not have a good case against Kyle Rittenhouse. Court of public opinion, certainly on the left, you know, very much a different story. So I would caution folks not to let their emotions get ahead of the facts in this case. Again, I don't know all of the specifics here, but I'm curious to see what a jury does. Is this going to be a jury trial, or is this a verdict from the bench?
It is a jury trial.
Okay.
And, you know, something like kind of to what you said, and when you look at that standard today that gives, that says, you know, a threat, either actual or perceived, if you take that, I mean, in this case, it's harder to look at because he has a cell phone. So the headlines of all the papers aren't, you know, of course, you know, officer shoots unarmed black man, and they don't even talk about the keys in the hand. But if you take that down to the next level and you say, hey, if you can only use deadly force, if it's an actual threat, well, then how about the guy who's pointing the unloaded gun at you? Or how about the kid who's pointing the BB gun that looks like a gun? Well, that's a perceived threat. I mean, it's not an actual threat when you find out later. So, I mean, we have to think about it. There's a lot of other things that come into play. And I think we need, unfortunately, this case was tragic, but you got to give law enforcement some of that leeway in these cases because of what they're facing. I mean, that officer saw you got to figure December 2020, what was going on. And there, you know, officers were being shot at all the time. They're having to double up on cruisers because of that. And so you put that all together, and that officer, you know, that threat was real to him, even to the point, Cam, that afterwards, when he found out that it was a set of keys, and he went and he was physically ill on the side of the house, I mean, so you can see that in that officer's mind on that day, with him yelling gun, 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 and with him being sick after, I mean, his perception was there was a threat of physical bodily harm or death, and that's why he reacted.
All right, well, we'll keep our eyes on this case this week in Columbus. And in the meantime, Eric, again, thank you so much for joining us on the program today. I really appreciate your time, and I'm, again, glad to know that you're trying to get the word out to gun owners and to your customers there about the importance of heading out and voting between now and Election Day.
Absolutely, and you can vote now. We voted, we actually voted Monday. Our family went out and voted. We got to get out to vote, and hopefully next time I'm on, we'll be talking about a victory in Ohio and with our nation.
Absolutely. Eric Delbert joins us from LAPD Firearms and Range in Columbus. Thanks so much for your time, Eric.
Great. Thanks, Cam.
My thanks to Eric for joining us on the program. By the way, tomorrow we're going to be talking with Dr. AWR Hawkins from Breitbart News. That's right. These streams are crossing Town Hall and Breitbart together here on Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. So I'm looking forward to that conversation. Right now, though, let's turn our attention to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report. We'll start there with a case out of Nashville, Tennessee. You know, Nashville, one of those cities in Tennessee where local leaders are saying, oh, the state legislature is not doing enough with gun control. We need more gun reform laws. No, you don't. You need to enforce the laws that are already on the books, and then you would end up with headlines like this. Teenager on probation for homicide, arrested after violent carjacking. So yeah, there's a lot going on in that headline, right? According to WTFV, which honestly, given this story, should be WTF. But anyway, 18-year-old Eduardo Melendez Pineda pleaded guilty earlier this year to criminally negligent homicide in connection with the death of 13-year-old Aaliyah Ingram. He was, again, apparently sentenced to probation. Aaliyah's life ended in November of 2022. November 21st of that year, a 15-year-old named Cesar Martinez was driving a stolen vehicle when he picked up Aaliyah and then was later joined by Melendez Pineda and two others. The car ended up crashing, rolling into a yard, and trapping Aaliyah underneath. According to Aaliyah's mom, Natalie Chastain, the entire group of teens, including Eduardo Melendez Pineda, left her daughter to die. They didn't run to the front door of that home and knocked. They didn't pick up their cell phone and call 911 and say, hey, our friend is trapped. Nope, they ran away. Both Melendez Pineda and Martinez were charged with criminally negligent homicide and received probation after their conviction or guilty plea. In fact, Melendez Pineda pled guilty on August 22nd of this year, just, what, less than 2 months ago, or about 2 months ago. He was charged as an adult with criminally negligent homicide, but he was sentenced to just 3 years of probation after taking that guilty plea. And then again, less than 2 months later, back behind bars. Last week, he and a 15-year-old accomplice accused of carjacking an SUV outside of the victim's home, during which Melendez Pineda allegedly fired a shot into the vehicle and another round into the air. The next day, officers spotted the stolen SUV. There was a police chase that led across two counties before the pair was taken into custody. WTFV spoke with Natalie Chastain, again, the mom of Aaliyah Ingram, that 13-year-old who was killed. She said there shouldn't be another victim. My daughter should have been it with that. That should have been what it took, or that should have been what took him off the streets. She says the legal system needs reform. She wants to see stronger sentences for violent crimes, even for minors. She says we've got to do something, because if not, there's going to be another victim. Now, again, gun control wouldn't have changed the outcome, right? Aaliyah Ingram didn't die because of a criminal misuse of a firearm. She died because a couple of teenagers stole a car, went joyriding in it, crashed that car, and then refused to get help for her when she was seriously injured. Now, I would also say that more gun control laws aren't going to stop teenagers committing violent carjackings like Eduardo Melendez Pineda is now accused of. He's 18 years old, right? Already a convicted felon. So he's already a prohibited person. He could not legally possess a firearm. And by the way, even though I am a big believer in, okay, you know, once you've get done with your sentence, you should have your rights restored, I don't think the courts are going to see it that way. Not for all felonies. We may get to a point where there needs to be a finding of dangerousness before somebody can be deprived of their right to keep and bear arms after a conviction. But in this case, being convicted of criminally negligent homicide probably would lead a judge to conclude that Eduardo Melendez Pineda is a dangerous individual who should not be allowed to possess a firearm. Certainly under the state of Tennessee's laws right now, Melendez Pineda is not eligible to possess a firearm. He is not old enough under federal law to purchase a handgun. So he already violated multiple gun control laws. Putting more of those laws on the books wouldn't have helped. What would have actually stopped that violent carjacking from being committed is if Eduardo Melendez Pineda had been sentenced to some time behind bars for the death of Aaliyah Ingram, instead of being given 3 years probation and allowed to return to the streets. All right, today's armed citizen story from Ohio, actually. Maybe should have talked with Eric Delbert about this, but maybe next time we have him on. Ohio judge deems 2021 fatal shooting stemming from argument self-defense. Suspect released. Well, he's not a suspect anymore. He was the victim of a crime. But Bethany Bruner of the Columbus Dispatch still labels Brian Smith as a suspect here, even though the criminal justice system has said no, the trial against him should not move forward. Brian Smith had chosen not to have a jury hear his case. He asked Judge Kim Brown to decide whether his actions that led to the death of Rodney Brown, 46-year-old man, were justified. Smith had argued that he shot Brown in self-defense during an argument back in 2021. Brown was found fatally shot around 7:30 on the evening of September 11th, 3 years ago, on a sidewalk behind a home there in Columbus. Judge Brown heard 2 days of testimony. So it wasn't just that Brian Smith said, hey, I acted in self-defense, and the judge said, okay, that's enough for me, right? 2 days of testimony here. Both prosecutors and the defense had the opportunity to put on witnesses. And after that 2-day hearing, Judge Kim Brown determined that the shooting did qualify as self-defense under Ohio law. Smith had been released in a $30,000 bond in the case. He had been held in custody originally, though, for more than a year. Now, thanks to Judge Brown's decision, he has officially been released from custody and supervision. He's never going to get that year back. The year behind bars that he spent for a shooting that was justified in the eyes of the law. I'm glad that Judge Brown made that decision. But I don't know what Brian Smith does to get back those 12 years that he lost waiting for the judge to determine that he acted in self-defense. Finally today, our good deed of the day, in the right place at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. A couple of hunters in Wyoming who came to the aid of a motorcyclist who had crashed. Here's the headline: man stuck under crashed motorcycle near encampment in Campman, Wyoming, saved by hunters. And this was, I mean, truly it sounds like a miraculous discovery on the part of Jason and Ben Kapersky, the hunters in question. They were driving down the road. They were elk hunting, and they were moving to a new spot when they spotted just the top of a brown cowboy boot being waved along the side of the road. Jason Kapersky told Cowboy State Daily, had we not seen the very tip of his boot move, you couldn't see him there. He said everything comes down to him waving a boot, because it would have been a whole different outcome if he hadn't. Now, the foot in the boot belongs to Phil Bollinger. He was trapped headfirst in a culvert alongside Wyoming Highway 70 after he had gotten into a crash, single vehicle crash. He was basically riding his motorcycle. He said he was decided to take a scenic route as he was heading from encampment to his home in Rawlins, Wyoming. He said, I got to the top of the hill before he stopped dropping down. The switchbacks are posted at 35 miles an hour. He said, I started coming down the first couple of switchbacks. I'm cruising along, enjoying the beautiful scenery. And as he comes around a corner, there's a herd of deer on the highway. So he swerves to avoid them. Then he hits a patch of gravel on the side of the road. He said, I was trying to keep my motorcycle on the road, make sure that nobody was beside me. He said, I didn't notice that there was a culvert that went underneath the road for drainage. And then I had a rock that stopped the bike immediately, threw me off to the left towards the road. He said, I landed in the culvert with my head going towards the entrance of the underground drainage. His bike lands on top of him. He could reach his phone. He tried calling 911, but there was no cell service. So he said, I started thinking about what to do. And I thought, well, if I hear a car coming, I'll just lift my leg and shake my boot around. and maybe somebody will see that, but he said everybody passed by and wouldn't slow down, at least until the Kaspersky's showed up on the scene. Jason Kaspersky said that when they arrived, they could tell that Bollinger was in a lot of pain, desperate need of medical attention. He said, you couldn't get a Hollywood stuntman to recreate the way it happened. You're talking about a 3-foot diameter culvert. He dived into it head first, going 25 miles an hour. He said, there was no way we were going to move him because you've got a possible spinal injury. Bollinger never lost consciousness, but it took a while. I mean, again, this is, you know, middle of nowhere, or my friend Selena Zito would say middle of somewhere, Wyoming. They managed to get a cell signal, talked to the Carbon County Sheriff's Office, but the dispatcher couldn't figure out where their location was. In fact, the system didn't even show the physical address of their cabin. So Cowboy State Daily says the solution was on the X Hunt app, which Jason Kaspersky downloaded on his phone, used it to determine where he was, and then share the location with first responders. He said, here's our exact latitude and longitude. We were able to give the dispatch the location immediately. He said the signal up there sucked, but on X Hunt was the key. It took about an hour for EMS to arrive. Jason Kaspersky says, we were sitting there feeling helpless. He said, all we could do is monitor this guy, keep him warm, and prevent him from going into shock. Again, after about an hour, Carbon County Sheriff Alex Backen arrived there on the scene. About a half hour after that, an ambulance arrived, and then a Metaflight showed up. According to Cowboy State Daily, it took until the ambulance arrived before the motorcycle could be lifted off of Bollinger's leg and get him out of the culvert. Jason Kaspersky helped find a suitable landing spot for the helicopter. After another 40 minutes or so, Bollinger was loaded up, taken to a hospital via helicopter in Fort Collins, Colorado. And even that was kind of a scary situation. Cowboy State Daily says there were signs of an imminent storm in the mountains there. The helicopter had to rise through the clouds once Bollinger was on board. Jason Kaspersky said there was a pretty heavy storm coming up. Heli barely got off the ground. The whole sky just opened up. 10 minutes later, we got the strongest winds we've ever had up there, and it rained hard for over an hour. It was the most insane thing that he has ever seen. I mean, again, this could easily have been one of those cases where nobody saw Mr. Bollinger. And, you know, he just passed away at the side of the road. But Jason and Ben Kaspersky in the right place at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing to save Phil Bollinger's life. And thankfully, Bollinger, who is still in the hospital, but is on the road to recovery, is alive and well today because of the kindness and quick thinking of strangers. And perhaps the OnX hunting app. That's pretty good advertisement for that app as well, I'd say. All right, that is going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms Cam and Company. I want to thank you for being a part of the program as always. Looking forward to seeing you back here again tomorrow. Again, our guest will be Dr. A.W.R. Hawkins of Breitbart News. We'll be talking about the latest in the elections, including the Washington Free Beacon's discovery of audio of Kamala Harris talking about, yeah, you know, a ban on guns would be great. But I just don't think we can get there. At least not right away. Will any mainstream media outlet cover those comments? I highly doubt it. But we'll be talking about our tomorrow's Cam and Company. We'll see you then. Until then, be sure to check out BearingArms.com throughout the day. We're keeping you up to date on all the latest Second Amendment news and information. And we'll see you back here tomorrow. Until then, be well. Be safe. And be free.